and Tanzanian culture. As nice as it is outside now, I'm surprised that any of you came in. I'd almost like to join you for a walk out there. We started yesterday talking about Tanzanian religion and culture as a religion of relationships, and we talked about their view of creation, and now we're going to move on to sickness and health and hopefully person and community, and maybe tomorrow finish up with the others. I don't care how far we go, as much as you want to talk, we can. I mentioned yesterday that they have a very holistic sense of creation, and that the visible and the invisible are melded together and they interpenetrate one another, and every time, according to their writers, every time they see something and touch something that's visible, they're reminded of something invisible. And so the invisible world impinges upon them. It's really a very strong sense of the spiritual in their teaching about creation. And then at the end I was saying that this means that they are holistic. I've always thought that should be spelt W-H-O-L-L-I-S-T-I-C instead of H-O-L-I-S-T-I-C. But that's what it is for them anyway. They're holistic. Holistic in the sense that they don't have the dichotomy between matter and spirit that we often have had in our tradition. And that may be true of almost all primitive peoples. We've become dichotomized more because of what has happened to us from the period of the Enlightenment on about 200 years ago. But we're trying to get over that now. Another way that they are holistic, we said, is that they maintain that their ways of receiving knowledge are more than that of reason. I don't know how much you're willing to admit this or not, but Western peoples almost always live and act like the only way we know anything is through our reason. And they would say reason plus, reason plus intuition, reason plus dreams, reason plus visions, all sorts of ways whereby, other than through the normal senses, they say we can open up and learn. This became kind of evident to me when I remembered one time hearing an African evangelist preach on the Transfiguration text, the Transfiguration of Our Lord, you know, where, and he had a marvelous time with that text, kind of different than sometimes we do. Maybe your pastor does a real good job with that text. I remember hearing it once when someone who, they read it, they even read the part that's not understandable to us so quickly, they almost passed over it. You know, that part where Jesus has a conversation with long-dead Moses and Elijah. Because our world doesn't have too much room for having conversations with dead people. And so the preacher skipped over that, and then he talked about the last part of it when they were trying to heal someone, when they came down from the mountain. And Jesus said, this kind of sickness comes out only by prayer. And then they talked on prayer. But prayer also, of course, is in the realm of the extra-rational and the super-rational. The African evangelist who preached on this text says, what a marvelous story we have this morning. We have Moses, who is the epitome of the law in the Old Testament, the great figure of the law, and Elijah, who is the great prophet of the Old Testament. And then we have Jesus, who specifically said, I came not to destroy, but to fulfill the law and the prophets. And then this guy said, what would be more natural than that Jesus called these two people together when he was in the process of bringing these marvelous works to fruition? No embarrassment at all that there was fellowship with those who had already gone before. But in a way, we haven't abandoned all that, because we do keep the scriptures as they are. We haven't, if you wanted to purge the book of Acts, for example, of experiences like that, you wouldn't be left with very many pages, because almost on every page in Acts, you've got some sort of a vision or some sort of a dream that changes the lives of people and others. Well, all I suppose we want to say here now is that this means that that Africans are aware of the fact that there are many ways to experience and to know other than just through our reason. It may well be that we know that just as well, but it may be that we've enclosed ourselves, encased ourselves in a time-space box in such a way that is foreign to them. The holistic nature of their cosmology, their worldview, also is evident in many of the things that I think we see in their newly independent countries. Tanzania has a constitution that is a constitution of a secular state, just much like ours, you know, that says that secular comes from the Latin word seculum, which means of this age. And so the Constitution says that we are concerned with things that have to do with this side of death. We don't know about the other side. Religion is up to other people, not to the state. And they have that kind of a constitution, but they don't live by it, because they have this holistic view behind them all the time. For example, their government schools have religious instruction in them. They invite the churches to come in and 2 hours a week in their school, even in some places 4 hours a week. And they chide us if we don't teach them. The Muslims can come and teach too, but they don't. So the only ones that really do are the Christians. And they do this by saying that we can't have a society without religion, because if we don't have religion, we'll lose our morality. And so they don't have this worry we have about separation of church and state in the same way. It's also witnessed by sikukus, by festive occasions. I remember a time when one of our graduates of our seminary was ordained, and we were close enough, we were able to go to the place where he was ordained. And the bishop, of course, was there, and the ordination was handled really by him, but so was the district officer, the government district officer, and two or three of them. And they also had to stand up and say, now this is our person. We now welcome him too, because he's ours just as much as he is yours of the church. And this reflects this holistic view that they have toward life, I think. I don't know for sure how much you feel this is different than what you've experienced. We can talk about that, or we can go on a little bit to sickness and health, and then talk about it later if we want to. I'm confused after coming home now. I'm confused about this business about not being able to say a prayer in the schools and all that sort of thing. It's not my kettle of fish the way I've been oriented for 36 years over in Africa, but maybe this is the way Americans feel about this. I'm not really sure. But it does show that we have a difference in how we look at the world. Is it all tied together, or can you compartmentalize it in ways like that? Anyone want to comment on that?
The answer I received when I asked questions about it from the advocacy to the government was that we got many religions in the States now, more than before. There are Muslims, there are Jewish, there are others, and that therefore we shouldn't impinge upon them, but that we should expect our parents to teach our children. If they're Christian, they should be Christian in their homes, and up to the children would be taught in their homes rather than expected to be taught in the schools.
All right, thank you. And
I was going to say about the same, only that it's possible over there in Africa, because the people in various nations are very homogeneous.
Yeah.
Say, like in Tanzania, maybe there are from other countries, but local, I mean, still black people The philosophy probably and feeling is about the same.
Yeah.
Now here we have such a mixture of populations from Africa, from Europe, local people, I mean Americans as you say. It would be harder to achieve that holistic view because the white man is always was, is still trying to persuade the others that his religion or his philosophy is the best.
Yeah.
And I have a feeling that in the African continent it's probably different in all of it.
Thank you. That's helpful. They now have, they're not so homogenous now as they used to be either, you know, because when the Arabs came with the slave trade, they brought Islam. So now you have Islam and the traditional religion, and then Christian missionaries came, and so you have Christianity. And now Tanzania, we used to say, was a third or something, and now I guess they say it's almost a half Christian and a quarter Islam and a quarter traditional. And what they say now, in their, like when they have this, they call it release time, really, but it's right in the school, you know. And they invite the different groups to come, and no one is forced to attend. But the truth is, the only one to take them up on it are the Christians. So it's become quite an important thing for us, and it costs us a lot. We have to pay the evangelists who do this, you know, ourselves, as out of our own offerings. And it's an important part of the evangelist work. If they got, say, two schools in their area, two primary schools, that means 4 half-days a week where they're busy with that sort of thing, or almost.
Like when you say pay, you mean the Lutheran Church or the church?
Yeah.
Itself.
Yeah.
Indigenous.
Yeah, the offerings of the people. That's what I said. The offerings of the African Christians have to pay for that. It's true they do other things. They teach the catechetical classes, and they preach on Sunday and counsel with the people who are fighting and all that sort of thing. But nevertheless, it is an important thing. And the church thinks it's important enough to put some time. We put out books to guide them as they do this from class to class and so forth.
I think our Lutheran Church did very, very well in the religious instruction, and the books that were published were extremely well received in all of the Protestant churches, right, in Tanzania.
Right. It was, well, we're the one of the only ones that really did it all the way from all the classes.
Can you imagine? First grade up to 12?
Yeah.
Isn't that right?
Yeah, right.
First grade to 12, and they're all taught in religious instruction in the schools.
And the
materials.
And the material had to be provided by the church.
I wish that could
tremendous.
Be
tremendous.
That could be tremendous here.
Yeah.
Because I think it put emphasis on the loss of the church and the decrease in Christianity.
Yeah.
Not having
some. Well, we have a lot of young people who come to be Christians, who come from non-Christian homes because of the school class.
Yeah, Bill's got a point that now the question is, like what this man told you, Les, is right, but how many homes in America are willing to take the responsibility of really teaching their children, seeing that they get to church and so forth? So there is a gap in many, many places now here. I'm not saying that we had to go back to the old, I don't know exactly what's right. I'm saying that there are differences in the way we view the whole universe, and the Africans say the universe is basically spiritual. And when you see something visible, it's kind of like Plato, you know. When you see something visible, it's a sign of the invisible and the powerful. And so they make a lot of room for that. And they live that way.
Look, I think we can give them the opportunity there, not deny. That's what they are doing, denying us from having them.
Yeah.
And I think we have rights too.
Yeah.
All the rights are on the young church.
Yeah.
Now we can't even have a baccalaureate service.
No, right. And that's why, for example, it's amazing. We had to pass a school levy at Bonner's Ferry in order to keep the thing moving, because we didn't pass the bond, but we had to pass something so you get going. And so you get into these discussions, you know, and you we had an adult hour in church lined up on it, and it gets pretty hot because you got some people are willing to give up the whole thing, and they say, let's just have private schools, huh? Let's let's homeschool or something, you know, because they think it looks so dark and that sort of thing. Well, I don't think homeschooling would be a thing Africans would say they should ever do. First of all, they couldn't, but then also they just do things in community. We're coming to that, huh? And it would be odd.
They're more dependent on each other.
Too. Yeah, right.
Parochial schools is on the increase in the United States.
Yeah, it looks
that
way.
Yeah. And maybe that'll be the way we can move over.
And I say, what's wrong with a Christmas program so that others can know?
Yeah.
You know, you're not forcing others to believe or to accept it, but so that they know another culture or another religion. Right.
I have my own kind of theory about this. What you say is absolutely right. I kind of think that America has gone a little overboard on this because of the fact that we have so hooked ourselves into the scientific worldview that we feel the truth is limited to that which can be proven in a scientific way. And then that is public truth. But if it's truth other than through the scientific method, then we say that's got to be entirely a private thing. You know, I don't think that's true. I think that God and religion are also public truth. Huh? But I admit we got problems, and the problems are we got different religions. And just how we're going to do this all, I don't know. Well, I think we should move on to sickness and health. Huh? I thought of this so much the last couple of days when I've been listening to Tom Drogue here in this room on holistic health or whatever the topic is he's having, because some of it kind of jibes. Well, first let's just talk a little bit about sickness in African traditional thought, and for a real traditionalist in Africa, if he becomes sick, the first question he asks is, whom have I quarreled with? Where's the argument? Huh? And the argument may be that you and I have quarreled, and in the process you put a curse on me or something like this. Or it may be between the sick person and the member of the living dead. The living dead, we said, are those who have died but are still remembered on earth. Huh? The ancestor spirits is another way of talking about it. Like if I beat Elaine mercilessly and was bad to her as my wife, maybe her father, who is a member of the living dead, would come back to haunt me and to curse me and to put a sickness upon me. And see, relationships, huh? And the relationships aren't always just between people on earth, but between people on earth and people who are beyond this veil of sin and tears, huh? And yet have a strong influence and power upon our lives. This should be taken with along what is health. We said before that in all of creation there's a secret power that God is trying to get across to people, according to the African worldview. It's called secret because it doesn't come about going to ordinary classes. It's called power because it affects people how they live from day to day. And this, it's kind of like, I don't know exactly how to put this in word, but it's kind of like the soul of the universe is on your side for health. Huh? It's trying to come through and give you health. And it comes through sometimes through nature, but it also comes through a hierarchy of beings like ancestor spirits and clan members who are gifted in healing and who distribute this power to other people. And this is on your side. I mean, in a way, we have something like that, don't we, when we say we're created in the image of God? I suppose we assume that God is healthy, and so if we're created in His image, we should be healthy. And we don't, I think, wake up every morning and say, what a surprise, I'm well today. Huh? Instead, we say, what a surprise, or what a rotten deal, I'm sick today. Huh? So we start to take it for granted that the norm should be, at least for a lot of our time, should be health. Huh? Well, they kind of look at it that way, it seems to me. But the truth is they have a lot to say about how when we have unhealthy relationships, broken relationships, this results in physical illness.
It's called stress.
Yeah, stress, we could call it, yeah, yeah. Well, I remember reading Fred Wellborn he was a warden in University of Makerere in Uganda for a long time, and his wife was a doctor and worked in a hospital, and I'm sure he's talking about her in the book, though he doesn't mention her. But anyway, this African man came to this doctor with headaches and stomach aches and so forth, and they did all the lab tests, couldn't find anything wrong in that, and finally come back again and they do them again and nothing wrong, and finally she sat down and talked to this person, and how are things getting along at home? Oh, awful, we fight all the time, my wife and I, you know, we're just throwing things at each other, I can't get in the door, but we have trouble. Huh? And so the doctor said, be reconciled to your wife, heal this wound and your headaches will go away. Well, he happened to tell his African pastor that. And the African pastor, being newly out of this kind of a life, said, you as a doctor are trying to return my member to the African way of healing, huh? And you're almost angry with him. It's how close, you see, the borderline was, huh? But yet, it's obviously true that when we have relationships when are unhealthy, they affect us, and they have a great effect, and can often cause sickness which is healed in no other way than settling the quarrel itself. I think it's fair to say, too, that in this, those who have this power to heal, or who are sort of medical practitioners in their society, there is a chance that they go astray. There's a Swahili word, mganga, which means medicine man, one who heals. And then there's a Swahili word, mchawi, which means sorcerer, witch, huh? Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting to know how did both of them come about then? How in almost every worldview, evil is there. Huh? There is no real primitive people or any other that see a perfect world. Yesterday we talked about a world that's estranged, that heaven moved far from earth and so forth. John Mbiti, the East African theologian, says a sorcerer is a medicine man who's gone berserk, huh? Or who's gone wrong, using his magical power for unsocial purposes. Huh? In fact, another author there says that witchcraft accusations represent the deepest and most universal expression of man's natural fear of men. His tendency to work out his pain and tragedy by creating havoc in the community rather than in healing. There is such a thing as witchcraft. There's no doubt about that. And there's a lot of things I can't understand it. Huh? And I can't go into it to make you understand it, but nevertheless, anyone who is a subject of that is frightened. Huh? But an mganga is an ordinary person who has some healing power and really does some good things, you know. He will counsel people to get along together and at the same time give them some rituals, so there's a religious aspect to it. Huh? And is many times a healing person. Beatty, who is a theologian and actually married a Swiss wife and lives in Switzerland, and writes about these things, but has, of course, a lot of African experience. He says that there are very few Wachawi and that we should just zero in on the Waganga, on the good people. My students in the Extension Seminary said that the Waganga also have a lot of desire to fool people, to exploit them, to get more cows and goats and other things out of them as they serve people. So it isn't as rosy as what's-his-name Beatty would have you expect. It's easy in the church, at least for many people, to even deride this one and say we don't want anything to do with the Mganga, and say that he's a crook and that he does things wrong and that. But I am not too happy about that, because I noticed that a lot of Africans go back to these people when they need the herbal medicines that they are experts in and that. And so I think there should be a more fair treatment of them than the church has usually given them. What do you think about this concept that sickness comes from broken relationships? What do you want to say about that? Any comments? Think there's some truth in it?
Yes.
Yeah. A lot of truth.
Definitely. Yeah. But it's not complete, because there's sickness from broken relationships and unhappiness, and there's sicknesses from outside surface sources that only medicine can make any impression on.
Yeah, very important. Now that's very true. Now, all right, let's talk about the strengths of their position and the weakness. And the weakness is, you said that there are some sicknesses that don't come from broken relationships, such as?
Well, sleeping sickness.
All right, you got germs and virus and things like that, huh?
Malaria.
All right, yeah. The malaria comes from being bitten by a mosquito who has an anopheles, who has something that gives you in the blood. If you push that with an African, they would say, yeah, but why did the mosquito bite me? You know, the thing that the weakness, first of all, one of them is like what you pointed out, some sicknesses are caused by germs, huh? And you can be reconciled to your wife as many times as you want to, but if you've got malaria or sleeping sickness or bilharzia or something, you better get the medicine that goes along with the germ. Now, don't be too hard on them, because they did know there were certain herbal medicines for certain things, you know.
Yeah.
But I suppose not to take care of malaria or other things like that. But they did use medicines along with their incantations. The medicine men did this. You had something else.
Speaking about malaria, is there any quinine roots in Africa?
Yeah, I suppose there are. I don't know.
It must be.
How much they used them, though, I don't know. I really don't, because they were surely defeated, did you?
Yeah. They also say that there are germs around us all the time, and we're ingesting them all the time, but not everybody gets sick with them, because their immunity is stronger. If you have a bad relationship with somebody, your immunity goes down.
All right.
You're more likely to.
Yeah, very important.
Bacteria that has entered your body, where the next person, it won't even face them.
All right.
That or if you have that sickness, and then bad psychological problems, more of a chance you're not going to recover.
Yeah, that's exactly what she says. The immune system goes down. Yeah. All right, you had a word.
I heard in an interview on TV of a young African doctor who despaired that his grandfather had been a witch doctor, And he felt that so many legitimate cures had been lost in Africa because those cures had been put down and the younger people had been trained in Western medicine and taught to ignore those things, and now most of those people are dead. And he felt that a lot had been lost in some very legitimate medications and whatnot.
Tanzania has kind of tried to take care of that because Tanzania has asked its Department of Medicine at the university to be alert for saving and preserving and zeroing in on these African cures. The problem probably wasn't so much that the medicine wasn't right. The problem in the past was that it was difficult to know what the dosage should be, you know, because of lack of experimentation with things like that.
So they've used digitalis for heart. They knew about it long before they knew how to measure it. So
yeah,
it was
right.
A matter of chance whether you get the right amount, but it still was the right thing to do.
Yeah, the first ones were kind of guinea pigs until you get a pattern. When Elaine showed pictures here last night, she showed in the marketplace one old guy that had it laid out in a gunny sack, spread out various herbal medicines that are there in the marketplaces, and they use them. And I think the thing had a point. TV production had a real point. I think that some of the African countries really are alert to this and are trying to do it, and to distinguish between that which were false cures and that which were reasonable and should be kept on. What other thing do you think? What other weakness do you see that's in this? Huh? If you're sick, probably because someone put the evil eye on you.
Well, in response to what you've asked, I've had cancer, and I do not feel that had anything to do with a broken relationship. But I have had shingles, and I feel certain it was a result. I wouldn't say broken relationships, but a relationship that wasn't healthy. And it was the man with whom I worked who created a lot of, it's stress in me.
Yeah.
And I really feel that was a result of and somehow I couldn't throw that off and took it in internally, the stress, and then I got the shingles.
Yeah.
But the cancer, I could not equate that at all with broken relationships.
No, right. Well, none of us would want to go back and say that this is the whole truth in any way. I'm here alive today. I had a laminectomy performed on my spine in 1967, and without all the best that medicine have, I wouldn't be here, you know. And but at the same time, you can be alert to the fact that many of our illnesses and problems do come from relationships which are broken and so forth. I think that one of the weaknesses of the African setup after living there is that they push to the nth degree this why. Why am I sick? You know, who did it and why? And you know, you can spend the rest of your life hunting something like that down. And I always felt it was part of the church's task to say, look, there are some things we don't know. Some things we'll never understand. You just can't always have an answer to everything. And so maybe one of the things we have to tell them is that there aren't some of these answers. Huh? Another thing that bothered me and that bothers my doctor friends, Mark Jacobson's another that we've talked about, and that is that if you really feel your sickness comes to you because someone has put the evil eye on you, it does this, it gives you the impression it's coming from outside of you so completely that you give up in despair of being able to do anything yourself to get the thing on the road again. You know, you just think that if someone else has done it, I can't do anything about it, and therefore I'm just a helpless ploy, a little football that gets kicked around. Huh? And this can be devastating too, because you have to have some sort of conviction and confidence you're going to be able to handle this and get over it and so forth.
It's just like in any other action in the world. If you spend your time blaming somebody else because you didn't come out right, well, you're not going to get very far.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. I remember when I was in the residential seminary teaching, had a student from Dar es Salaam area. I remember his first name was Peter, I can't remember the other, but he was a little little different than the other students, not too social and so forth. And he told me that he was in the clan in his tribe, in line to be this medicine man, was to learn all the arts from his, I don't remember, father or uncle or somebody and everything. Then when he decided to come to the seminary, of course, he had to give this up, and it bothered him. But I questioned him a lot, what kind of training did you get in that? And it was pretty thorough, you know. They spend years teaching them what kind of medicines are used, and even the incantations and prayers that go with it, you know, and the rituals, you jump over the body or something, you know, the sick person to... I suppose the ritual has something to do with the... What did we put the name on that the other day? When you take a medicine that isn't really a medicine, you know.
Placebo.
Yeah, that's right. Maybe there's something like that involved in there.
Yeah. At the same. Convince the person that you're working on, the jumping over back and forth, is going to help him.
Yeah, that's right. And it will help some. All right. Any more questions or? Comments you want to do on the African view of sickness and health? You know, there are. Tom already pointed this out. The Greek word sozo means both to save and to heal. And soter, savior, is both a savior and a healer. You can translate it either way. And soteria, salvation or healing. You know, either. That kind of goes along with this. I always felt I had a point where I could talk to the Africans about this kind of salvation that comes from healing broken relationships. Huh? And salvation is healing as well as salvation. Huh? A lot of meat for thought when you tie these up together. And Africa, maybe, I'm sure that our ancestors way back had just as much an emphasis on the importance of relationships as the Africans had. But somehow or another, we began to put all our eggs in the basket of pills and injections and everything. And now we're trying to balance this out a little more and see that there is more to healing than just not being sick, huh? And so forth. All right. Let's move on to, I don't want to talk about death yet because that's part of the next thing that's coming here. Let's move on to person in community. I think I am right in that if you would have a chance to live 3 to 6 months in an African community, the strongest thing that you would take with you when you left is their sense of community. How they see that they are truly a part of a family, an extended clan, a tribe, and if they're in today's world, even a nation. Very important for them. They really say that an individual isn't an individual. You know, he isn't anything unless he's connected with his people. I remember Yuda Kivuvele was trying to tell us one time about this, and he says, you know, when you get two rivers that meet, right where they join, they have no name. And then when they get down a ways, or one river that, you can say two rivers that meet. Right where they join is none, then becomes something else. That's what a person is who's all alone, who's a rogue, who's cast off from his people. He doesn't have a name. He's not anybody. I asked the same man one time when the African church sent some delegates to a World Council of Churches meeting somewhere. I don't remember where it was even. And the report came back over the radio that they had said some things and that which seemed to us to be most unreasonable, huh? and wrong. Huh? And I asked Yuda, I said, how could it be that they said this? Well, he says, they were away from home. He said, they were out there like some people who had no moorings. They weren't surrounded by their people. They weren't part of a community. And so they say stupid things like that when they're out there alone, he says. And the Africans have a phrase when they go to see somebody, if you don't if they aren't there, aren't home, instead of coming back and saying Hakuepo, it wasn't there, they come back and say Nilimkuta Hayupo, which translates, I met him or her not there. And I asked them, well, why don't you just say they're not there? And they said, well, you know, in a sense, we did meet them. We saw the chickens and the goats and maybe some other people and the where he lives and the trees, and that's all a part of him. Huh? And so, in a sense, Tulimkuta Hayupo, huh? Instead of, we met him not there, instead of, he just wasn't home. Huh? And that's part of their sense of community as well. They have ways whereby they try to keep people in community. When we get to this, it's ways whereby they try to get them back in if they're out of it. But they have what we can call, you can call it a number of things, the anthropologists call it rites of passage, Africans call it Ngazi ya Maisha, which translates the ladder of life, and so we'll honor them by using their simile. Huh? So you have a ladder of life, and we'll start with birth, and then puberty, and then marriage, and then parenthood. Maybe we should really put these two together, because the purpose for marriage is to have children. and then uzee, that's a Swahili word which means an old person, old age. And there's a ritual when you get to that. And I don't know a lot about it, but what I know I'll tell you. I saw a beautiful thing one day, I thought. And then there's death, when you become a member of the living dead. Now, if we look at these, we can see that all these are concerned with keeping people in community. Birth. Let me read a statement here, if I can. In African societies, the birth of a child is a process which begins long before the child's arrival in this world and continues long thereafter. It's not just a single event which can be recorded on a particular date. Nature brings the child into the world, but society creates the child into a social being, a corporate person. For it is the community which must protect the child, feed it, bring it up, educated, and in many other ways incorporated into the wider community. The birth of a child is therefore the concern not only of the parents, but of many relatives, including the living and the departed. Kinship plays an important role here, so that a child cannot be exclusively my child, but only our child. So a child is very important because a birth is very important because it's a continuation of the clan. The clan stretches way back and way forward, and a child is important because of this. There are a lot of things to do with naming, and there's more celebration over a male child than a female child. Probably for one reason, there's more celebration over the male child as a male child, they figure in there, will continue the clan, whereas the female child will marry someone and become part of another clan. Also, the male child, they have these, what do you call this, Elaine, when they vigelegele back there? Trill. Yeah, the trilling. You ever heard Africans do that? They way back in their voice. It's a almost piercing sound that comes out. The women make it, huh? And there is more trilling for a male child than for a female child. The second reason for that, probably the first one being that what I said, the second one is that the male child is the one that's given the task of sacrificing annually on the grave of the father, so that the relationship between the living dead and the dead is whole. And even almost everything in Africa is done in phases. Like this man says, you know, it just didn't happen all at once that the child was born. There's a lot that went on before, and a lot that the Chaga will 1 month, seven days after a child is born, they'll take it to the father's parents, and the grandma and grandpa on the father's side, and show the child to them. A month after that, they take it to the maternal grandparents and show the child to it. And a month after that, they hold it up to Kilimanjaro and pray that the God of the world will take care of the child and guide and direct it. And so for the regular ritual, you know, with all this. But you see, it's 7 days, a month, and then a month later. Mm-hmm. I mean, things are phased out. And in this process, they do it in different ways and different times, but they all have naming ceremonies. Often children are named according to circumstances surrounding the birth. Maybe the mother gave birth when on safari, so the kid will be called Safari. Huh? Mm-hmm. Or maybe the child was born on Saba Saba Day, a national celebration, so it will be called Saba Saba. But more important to them, and this I found to really be true among the Warush, is if they could name a child after an ancestor, a member of the living dead. For example, Kim Murray, my colleague, would tell me, he told me that one of his children had a forehead like his grandfather, a high forehead. And so it got the name of the grandfather, a name of the living dead. And that was with some other names, of course, but the naming was very important. And when you ask someone in Africa what his name is, you don't ask what his name is, Jina Lake Nini. You ask Jina Lake Nani, who is your name? Because the name has just an awful lot of personality right in it, see. Birth surrounded by ritual and mystery. There's the umbilical cord has to be taken care of in a certain way. There has to be purification rites for the mother. The umbilical cord is buried probably in the courtyard, and some marker there or some tree planted maybe on it where it was buried as a sign that this child is now part of the kraal, part of the clan. If they live near a river and the river is an important part of their life, the umbilical cord is, there's a ceremony where it's thrown into the not only the cord, the placenta, you know, the whole thing thrown into the river. We have a young man at Bonner's Ferry who spent his early life, Dagnishek, out in Africa, and knows quite a bit of their customs and loves Africa. And he and his young wife had their first child a while back, and it interested me. They had a midwife come to the home, and the child was born there. And so he took the placenta and buried it out in the yard and planted a tree over it, just as they would have done in Africa. That was very important. And that's one of the reasons that many of the traditional African women wouldn't go to the hospital to have their babies, because they couldn't be sure of what was done with the placenta. Elaine and I were at a sub-center one time in Sonjo, way up in the northern part of Tanzania, and we stayed at a Catholic little padre's house there that was vacant at the time. And right next to it was a big, nice birthing clinic that the Catholics had built, but it was empty. And we were studying theology with them in an extension course with some students from there then. And they said, that's the reason it's empty, because we don't know. We can't get the mothers to come here because they aren't sure what will happen to the placenta. Huh? We won't. And then I asked Kim Ray, well, how did he handle that around Arusha? And he said, well, we figured that hospital was ours. So whatever was done with the placenta there was done in our name as a community, and therefore it was okay. purification rites for the mother. My colleague was a Marush himself, Kim Ray, and he got in a lot of trouble by battling that an awful lot. And he said, out of something as beautiful as birth, how can we get the idea that there's something dirty that has to be cleansed and purified? But yet it's very much like the Old Testament, you know. There's a purification rite. The Warush and the Wameru, both whom we work with most, there'd have to be a time when they were by themselves, secluded, and they couldn't prepare the husband's food or anything while they were in this state. There were a certain number of days, probably a month, and then when they were finally declared pure, then they could come back into circulation again. What?
It sounds like a smart deal to me.
It sounds like you get a little rest that way anyway.
The baby was not with mother then during
that. Oh, yeah. The baby's with him. Yeah, the baby's with him, but other people can't be. You know, I couldn't help but think of that. You probably read about how we got in the paper at Bonner's Ferry in that area because of this Randy Weaver standoff. You know, I was only 20 miles from our home. And when they finally came up there and found out how everything was in that little hideout up there on the mountain, Randy Weaver's wife, who had been killed, by the way, you know, there was a little menstruation hut for her where she had to go during that time. Because I think their religion was pretty much a little hodgepodge of a little Old Testament here and there. They worship Yahweh. And that's the Hebrew name from which we get Jehovah, huh? Yeah. And also she gave birth up there, so that they said was her birthing hut as well. I'd like to know a little bit more about that.
You haven't got much time left now, but I've been thinking all along when you're talking about person and community.
Yeah.
I don't know if this happened in your area, but in our area, Tano Youth Group was so strong, and if somebody was out of line, they'd ostracize them.
Yeah.
So that would mean a terrible thing then in this community.
Oh,
right?
Yes, they wouldn't.
I know there was one of my own evangelists who was... Yeah. Ostracized. They wouldn't talk to him.
Yeah.
But I talked to him.
Yeah.
And I mean, goodness sakes, yeah. In that clan then, or in that philosophy, he was exiled.
Yeah, ostracism is very severe if it's done. See, when Philip's father, the young man that was ostracized because he became a Christian in our area, ostracized him, he also cursed him and anyone who helped him in this. He cursed Elaine and me because we had been part of the helping and all the other people. And that's very, very, very serious for them, you know. When he finally put the curse on him, Philip came to me and, you know, and he says, I'm a Christian, but he says, I'm really worried, you know. This is no. And so we talked, we read the scriptures and that, and then at the end, I read this place in Revelation where in the kingdom of heaven there is no curse that can reach you, you know, and he was really helped. He thought that was great. And then he came back 2 weeks later and he said, Pastor, I know that if you're in Christ, no curse can reach you, but tell me again, will you? Yeah.
What do they call it?
Kulani. Lani.
Yeah.
Yeah, in their word, you mean?
Yeah.
It's Kulani. Mm-hmm. But you wouldn't expect it to be the same all over, you know. In the Philippines and that, it'd be a different name. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Some called shunting, you know, or removal.
Mm-hmm. Well, we got... We got 5 minutes to go on a little bit about puberty, huh? Or you want to talk more about this first birth? Puberty is when you become an adult, huh? And the circumcision act and the circumcision rite and the circumcision education are what's very important to that. It's not just an operation. The men, there is the circumcision of the male, as it's done many places in the world. And then for the women, there's the excising of the clitoris. But the important thing about this and we can talk about that later, even tomorrow if you want to, but the important thing about this is that it's surrounded by education. When they started getting formal education there, some of the young men would bemoan the fact and would tell me, ah, our fathers never had any education for us till now, when finally a government comes and starts giving. And I said, that's nonsense, you know, because the whole circumcision rite was truly a big education program. It started, it took several months. The boys go out all by themselves in a camp with, and then a few of the elders visit them, and the women likewise there, and there's strong instruction. How do I act as an adult now? Huh? What does it mean to be an adult in this society? To the girl, how do you act for your, toward your husband? It was very male chauvinistically oriented, and the old women taught him to be submissive and all that. We aren't supposed to know this, but it leaks out. Huh? And the men were taught how to be brave and how to... The division of labor was greatly enforced in the circumcision education. And the division of labor was, up to this time at least, unfair to the women. You know, the women had to carry the water, the women had to cook the food, and the women had to milk the cows, and the women had to gather the firewood. Well, I mean, that was all right when you were surrounded by those things right next door, but then you get population pressure and you got to walk a half a day for all those things. Well, you know, obviously, and the Christian Church is one of the agencies that slowly, slowly has begun to change this division of labor, but it was very strong. That's taught. It's also a bonding in... with your age group, because they take a 5 to 7 year span, and everyone in that 5 to 7 years is circumcised at the same time. Mm-hmm. And that's your age group then. And there's a special bonding between those of the age group, particularly for the men. And it's a bonding that is sealed in pain, and the pain of the operation is the pain. I don't know about the girls, but I know about the men. I've been there, they've invited me along with it, and they are told that they can in no way show pain. Huh? You must be stoic. Huh? No way can you show that there's any pain in this and all. Well, we can talk more about this tomorrow as we go on to marriage. Marriage, you'll think, is very, very interesting, huh? Because marriage is the one that... It's sort of where the rubber hits the road, huh? Where you see the difference in society. And so
how old were those boys? 13 or
yeah, 13, yeah. From 12 to 17 is a rule, somewhere in there. Don't you think?
Yeah, depended on, because at least in the Wabush on my side, they would have circumcision for like so many years, 5 to 7 years, and then there would be a period when they wouldn't have the circumcision. So all the boys that were within a certain age group within those years would be circumcised, and they circumcised some of them younger because it would be a number of years before they would have the circumcision rites again.
Yeah.
And
so,
yeah. I
suppose... You know, Robert Bly has written this book, The Iron John, is it? Iron John or Iron Man? What is
Iron
it?
John.
Iron John, yeah. And he's this guy that's talking to Americans about that we need to reintroduce the bonding between males, you know, because he says American males don't know where they are now, you know, they don't have an identity, and they don't know whether to be feminists or be what, and so he's emphasizing that, and I couldn't help but think when I read that book about this bonding, it becomes very important. A member of your, even I who came from a different area, The men, when I lived there 15 years ago down in Sambu, for example, at last now, the men would say, how old are you now? When are you born? And they say, yeah, you're Rika Yetu, huh? You're of our age group. And they sensed there was a special affinity. Huh? Mm-hmm. And, well, okay, thank you very much.